This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the metaversal mind chamber where in 28 minutes you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, what exactly is the government's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda and can it succeed? Government schemes don't normally incite the Archbishop of Canterbury to call them ungodly. Last weekend, the Asylum Seekers to Rwanda plan, which the government claims will break the business model of the people smugglers, did just that. But leaving questions of morality aside, however important, exactly what is the plan? How will it operate? And is it likely to work? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what do we actually know about the new plan? Mark Easton is the BBC's home editor. Mark, I recall that when this idea was first floated in the newspapers, the idea was that people would be sent to Rwanda to have their asylum claims processed for the UK. Is that still what's happening?
No, it's a very different scheme now, and one actually that appears to be a rethink on the whole asylum process for the UK. This is saying that anyone who comes to the UK by any unofficial route, and that could be across the channel in a small boat, or it could be in the back of a lorry, or even, it might even be that you've come on an aeroplane but you haven't got the visa that you require. At that point, you could be liable to be sent to Rwanda, not to be processed, but to, as the Prime Minister said, rebuild your life there. This is a one-way ticket. That part of the plan only really emerged on the aeroplane with the Home Secretary as I was flying out to Kigali just over a week ago.
Do most asylum seekers in this country who get asylum, do most of them currently arrive by what the government calls illegal means?
Yes, vast, vast majority. You have to come to the UK to claim asylum. You cannot do it anywhere else in the world. Now, it's possible that somebody could come, you know, legitimately on a tourist or a work visa and at some point then claim asylum. So it's not impossible. But the vast majority of people who arrive in the UK and subsequently claim asylum would have come by a route that the government regards as unofficial. In some ways, it's a catch-22. You know, if you're coming from Iraq, from which there are no safe or legal routes, you have to come to the UK to claim asylum. But by virtue of arriving in the UK to claim asylum, you make yourself ineligible to claim asylum.
Now, so what will these people, once they have been sent to Rwanda, what will they actually be doing there?
The memorandum of understanding that's been signed, the deal, says that those individuals would go to Rwanda, where they would be encouraged to go through the asylum process in Rwanda to become a refugee in Rwanda. At the end of that, assuming that they are deemed to be refugees, at that point, they will be given long-term accommodation somewhere in Rwanda. There will also be support to help them find work and to settle in Rwanda.
Now, will they be free to just to move around in Rwanda and go and live where they want to and take the jobs that they want to?
Yeah, they're not going to be imprisoned there. I think from the Rwandan point of view, there is a very real desire to bring in new blood, and they'll get money from this as well. Let's be clear. I mean, there is a financial element to this for the Rwandans. We've heard about £120 million going to educational development projects, but that, I think, is no more than just a sweetener, really, a way of demonstrating good faith from the UK side. Each asylum seeker will have a price for the Rwandans to take them. We don't know what that price is. There's been some briefing around £30,000 per asylum seeker, but that would really depend on how long they were in the system in Rwanda. You know, experience elsewhere suggests that fee could be much, much higher.
Have they any criteria for deciding who would be sent to Rwanda, or could it be anybody who has come in illegally?
Well, we know that it's not going to be children because the Memorandum of Understanding with Rwanda makes it clear that they will be adults. But the government has been pressed numerous times to explain exactly who's going to be liable for this. As we've discussed, you will need to have come to the UK by an unofficial route. My understanding is that it's more likely to be single men because there have been some unofficial briefings from the Home Office that suggest that is where they are looking. But they are also very keen not to give, as they say, the people smugglers, the people traffickers, information on who and who is not liable for this procedure. And so they're keeping it pretty vague. They have been explicit that it could be women, but my expectation is that it will be focused primarily on single men.
Do we have any estimate on how many people the government thinks will go through this process in any given year or period of time?
Well, I mean, in a lot of ways, David, we are in the land of speculation here. However, in a briefing in Kigali, we were told that the UK government was thinking that perhaps tens of thousands of asylum seekers might go this route in the next few years. So there is significant ambition here. The aim, I think, is essentially to end the asylum process as we have known it. The Prime Minister made this point in a speech. He said that, you know, Brexit allowed us to take back control of legal migration, ending free movement from the European Union, and now the government wants to take back control of illegal migration. Well, putting aside the language, when it comes to asylum, obviously the UK government has no say in who comes across our border and then claims asylum in the United Kingdom. I think what they are imagining is that bit of the process would stop. So instead, and this is where the policy I think is moving, the UK government wants to establish a network of what they describe as safe and legal routes, and that the UK government would have a significant say in who actually comes to the UK as a refugee or anything else.
Mark Easton. Now I want to find out about the precedents for the scheme. Has anything like this been tried before? The Briefing Room's Ben Carter spoke to Alexander Betts, Professor of Forced Migration and International Affairs at the Refugee Study Centre at the University of Oxford.
If we look back at the history of offshoring asylum seekers, where do we start?
Offshoring asylum has a long history. These are not new policies. If we turn to the mid-1990s, the United States, for instance, was offshoring asylum processing to Guantanamo Bay, an island that was later better known for housing terrorists in the context of 9/11. And the US Coast Guard would intercept Haitians and some Cubans en route to the United States and drop them off at Guantanamo Bay, where they were detained. That was an example of a country trying to place asylum processing outside the jurisdiction of the country. Most famously, Australia then picked up on the idea in 2001. When the Howard government pioneered what became known as the Pacific Solution. And working with other governments like Papua New Guinea, like the island of Nauru, Australia over time tried to do asylum processing for those people who arrived by boat in those sovereign territories. And it's been extremely controversial over time. It's been extremely costly because it's cost the taxpayer the equivalent of over £1 billion over the last decade, for instance.
And if we now turn our attentions to European countries, what have the plans been there over the years?
Ideas for offshoring are not new in Europe. We saw, for instance, in 2003, nearly 20 years ago, the British government, then under a Labour government, actually pioneered a series of ideas for what they called transit processing centres, spaces outside the European Union where asylum seekers could be sent to have their refugee claims assessed and then possibly subsequently then be brought back to Britain or Europe. So one initial idea was to work with the European Union, with like-minded countries such as Denmark, on siting processing centres in countries like Croatia, which then was outside the European Union. Germany and Sweden vetoed it. So Britain then looked outside of the European Union and actually approached Tanzania in order to process those asylum claims. Tanzania refused that deal. It didn't want to be part of it, and the ideas were dropped. But it was a very interesting phase when Britain was piloting what it called a new vision for asylum policy. Asylum numbers were at a record high in Britain, and the government and the Home Secretary, as today, believed it was very important to have a different approach and to try offshoring. But it wasn't successful at the implementation level, and a number of questions were asked about whether it was legal and compatible with international refugee law.
And Denmark have been looking at this too, haven't they? What have they been doing?
Denmark has been part of the conversation on offshoring asylum for many years, but it hasn't actually implemented anything. But what it has done recently is pass legislation to mean that asylum seekers in Denmark can be transferred to a third country to have their asylum claims assessed.
UK aside, have other countries considered Rwanda as an offshoring site?
In 2013, Israel approached both Rwanda and Uganda to take Eritrean and Sudanese asylum seekers that had arrived in Israel. Its proposal was for what it called voluntary departure, whereby it would give asylum seekers the choice of being housed in a detention centre in the Negev Desert in Israel or being relocated to East Africa. But upon arrival in Rwanda, many people had their travel documents that had been produced by Israel confiscated. They weren't recognised by Rwanda. And they were actually housed in closed hotels that were guarded, and they weren't allowed to move freely within Rwanda. And as a result, when they had the opportunity, research from the University of Oxford, amongst others, has shown that many embarked on using smuggling networks to try and reach Europe. So many of those Eritreans and Sudanese left Rwanda and embarked on dangerous journeys to Europe. The scheme was therefore abandoned and was seen as a failure after around 4,000 people had been transferred from Israel to Rwanda.
What does history tell us about how sustainable the schemes we've been talking about have been over time?
History shows us that many of these schemes have been proposed in the past and have fizzled out. They've been unworkable and unimplementable. The only scheme that's endured over time is Australia's solution. And even there, there's some suggestion that Australia may be rolling back on its bilateral deal with Papua New Guinea, even if it continues with Nauru. What's also clear is that even in the Australian case, there's reason to doubt the sustainable impact of these schemes. Over a decade, Australia has offshored just 3,000 asylum seekers at an enormous cost to taxpayers of over £1 billion.
And if we look at the latest proposals from the UK government, how different is it from the schemes that we've been talking about?
Most of the schemes from the past are about taking asylum seekers to another country where their claims are assessed and then allowing those recognised as refugees to be brought back, or to receive resettlement in another country, as has been the case with the Australian scheme. However, what's distinctive about this proposal is the transfer of asylum seekers and refugees to another country on a one-way ticket that transfers full responsibility to a third country. Something like that has never been tried and successfully implemented. It's what makes it different from the Australian scheme, for instance.
Alexander Betts. These proposals, then, represent a major departure from past practice. So what are the legal implications? Nick Rollison is a partner with the law firm Kingsley Napley. He currently acts as an officer for the International Bar Association's Immigration and Nationality Committee. Nick Rollison, when someone arrives in your country to claim asylum, what does the law say about how you should treat them?
Well, the law is divided up into various international provisions and also UK provisions. So generally, international law, particularly the UN Declaration of Human Rights, says that individuals have a right to claim asylum. Then we have the 1951 Refugee Convention, which says that individuals have the right not to be returned to countries where they would be at risk of persecution. And all of those provisions are rolled into national law in the UK.
Does it matter how people arrive when it comes to how they are supposed to be treated for the purposes of processing their asylum claims?
It shouldn't do, and certainly the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which is the guardian of the Refugee Convention, has also said that people shouldn't be treated differently if they arrive illegally.
Now, does the 1951 Convention prohibit cooperation with another country, say Rwanda,
actually the convention actually encouraged states to cooperate between themselves in order to try and solve this huge quandary, which is the asylum problem around the world, but only on the basis that those solutions don't actually make the situation for refugees worse.
And what would be the classic judgment on whether a situation for a refugee was made worse, other than the danger that they would end up back in the place that they were being persecuted?
I think that the issue is that that country itself needs to be fully compliant with all of the international human rights norms, including the European Convention on Human Rights, in ensuring that their rights are protected. They're not themselves then subjected to discrimination, to persecution, to inhuman and degrading treatment in that country when they arrive.
Is Rwanda, as far as you know, compliant with such standards?
Well, Rwanda hasn't had a great press recently. And if one looks at all of the international bodies that report on human rights, such as Amnesty, Rwanda's not doing particularly well. There are lots of issues around persecution of political opponents, of journalists. There's some issues around the LGBT community, which have been highlighted. So that's the real concern.
Now, what has the United Nations High Commission for Refugees said about the legality of the plan that has just been put forward?
The United Nations High Commission for Refugees has said that the plan is in breach of the spirit of international cooperation to increase the rights of refugees and ensure that they're not treated worse by any of these sorts of provisions. Its statements on how states should behave in relation to refugees are important and should be followed generally. Whether states choose to do that or not really is a matter of political choice.
So I'm wondering whether it matters that it breaches international law in actual practice.
I think that's a very good point, because there is the sort of embarrassment of being found to be in breach of these rules, but I don't think it's something that this government is particularly concerned about, as long as its UK Parliament issues legislation which is passed in a democratic way.
So is your understanding that the government proposal will be legal under UK law at the point where it becomes active?
Yes. So the Nationality and Borders Bill, which is currently going through the UK Parliament, contains provisions which would put these rules on not admitting people into the UK system and pushing them offshore into primary legislation if Parliament approves the final draft of the bill as amended by the House of Lords. We would have a legal basis for sending asylum seekers to a safe country, which is what I referred to before about making sure that Rwanda is a safe country. That is what's in the bill.
So in terms of a UK law, if those changes are made, the scheme would be legal here. But I'm presuming that it wouldn't be safe from legal challenges. Could you tell me what those would likely to be?
Yeah, so legislation made by the House of Parliament here can be subject to challenge under the Human Rights Act. So that's looking not at the Refugee Convention, but that's looking at the provisions of the European Convention on Human Rights. And we're expecting that there is likely to be some sort of challenge to all or part of these rules when they go through.
Is there any way you could evaluate what the chances of the success of such a challenge might be?
It's very difficult to say, but it is a fight that obviously the government has anticipated and expects to receive from what it calls politically motivated lawyers. The battle lines have been set out quite clearly. In terms of the prospects of success, it's fairly difficult, because if you look at particularly showing that people being sent to Rwanda will suffer, say, inhuman and degrading treatment, then one has to look at what the situation on the ground is in Rwanda. So there's a lot of sort of evidential stuff about what the practices are in Rwanda, and that may be very difficult at the beginning of these sorts of schemes when only a few people are being sent.
Let's say you are an asylum seeker and the government says to you, we're going to send you to Rwanda. What rights will you have to challenge that decision?
So in principle, you would be arguing that the decision is in breach of the government's own guidance on who should be sent, who should be assessed. So there is that fundamental right of judicial review, which exists for all government decisions. But as many people know, the government doesn't like judicial review of immigration decisions and is seeking to restrict that right.
But can I be clear? Judicial review is quite a long process, isn't it? And the government seems keen to get people to Rwanda pretty rapidly. Are you saying that the judicial process would be likely to hold up their being sent to Rwanda? or that actually it would play itself out once they'd been sent?
It could well be that it would play itself out once they've been sent, probably for the system to be workable and not to grind to a halt. The government will want to make sure that judicial review doesn't completely throw a spanner in the works of their new system. And, you know, we'll have to see what the High Court says on some of these early cases about whether or not judicial review suspends their removal while it's being decided, because that will be an important point.
Nick Rollison. Finally, the proposals claim to have the practical objective of breaking the business model of the people smugglers. So what is the scale of asylum seeking? How is that affected by people smuggling? And will the Rwanda scheme achieve what the government says it wants? Madeline Sumption is director of the research organisation, the Migration Observatory. Madeline Sumption, let's talk some numbers first. How many people claimed asylum in Britain last year?
Last year, the UK received around 56,000 asylum claims, if you include people's accompanying family members. So, of course, the question is that a big number? Well, it has definitely increased. It's up just under a quarter since 2019, and it's actually more than double historically quite low levels that we had about a decade ago. But by international comparison, it's not actually particularly big. So as a share of the population, the UK actually received considerably fewer asylum applicants than the average across the European Union, for example.
Okay, now what proportion of people who claim asylum in the UK claim it successfully?
This actually, interestingly, has really shifted a lot over the last 3 or 4 years. So typically, you know, if you went back 10 or 15 years ago, actually the majority of asylum applications were refused. And many of those decisions would be overturned at appeal, but certainly at the initial decision stage, most were not determined by the government to be refugees. What's happened over the last few years is really striking, which is that there's been a huge increase in the acceptance rates for asylum seekers. Back in 2018, around 33% of applicants had a positive decision, and that went up to 72% last year, which is the highest actually in over 30 years.
That's really fascinating. Why has that happened?
It's interesting. I don't think we have the full picture quite yet. Partly it's driven by who is applying. So we have more applications from countries that have higher success rates. So Iran, for example, is a country with a relatively high success rate for people claiming asylum. It appears that particularly in 2021, Brexit might have played some role because there were fewer people being refused on the basis that they could potentially be transferred to another EU country.
One of the things that's often said about asylum seeking in Britain, that it's mostly young men and that a significant proportion are economic migrants. In other words, people who wouldn't really be regarded as refugees. What can you tell us about the numbers there?
Well, historically, a majority of asylum applicants in the UK have been men. The gender balance does even out a little bit if you include family unification. So often it will be the man who makes the initial journey. And then once their claim has been accepted, they would be eligible to bring wife and children. Men obviously can also be vulnerable for a host of reasons that are very relevant to asylum claims. You know, for example, involvement in political activism, conflicts, forced conscription, problems related to sexual orientation. And actually, the Home Office data suggests that the success rates of asylum claims from women and men are actually pretty similar. The success rate of women is only a few percentage points higher than for men. And if you look at young men, the group that people are most likely to assume are economic migrants, last year, men between the age of 18 and 29, 73% of their decisions were successful. So I don't think that the statistical evidence enables us to say that actually someone's more likely to be an economic migrant just because they're a young man.
What can we say about the methods that asylum seekers use to successfully arrive in Britain?
We have some data on this, although it's definitely incomplete. We know that last year there were around 28,500 people who arrived in the UK in small boats, which obviously has attracted a lot of attention. And it is believed that almost all of them claim asylum, although there aren't a lot of official data on that. But others were using different routes, such as lorries or perhaps arriving by air with false documentation or on another visa that wasn't designed for claiming asylum.
Right. Now, let's get stuck into the question of the people smugglers and the business model that the government says it wants to disrupt. Do we have any idea what proportion of people who've come to the UK to claim asylum have paid someone else to help them get there?
We don't have data on the proportion who've used smugglers. The people arriving on small boats, not all of those people would be using smugglers, but the use of smugglers is very common, particularly on that route. And actually, one consequence of the increase in size of the small boats route compared to, say, people coming on lorries is that it appears to have increased people's reliance on smugglers, partly just because it's a more complicated and expensive operation than coming on the back of a lorry.
Obviously, the thing about small boats is that they're very visible. Do you think that given that everybody, almost everybody comes on a small boat, will be picked up immediately and could be subject to being sent to Rwanda, do you think the people smugglers will make adjustments to try and cope with that?
I think when you have any high-profile policy change like this, people respond and adapt in different ways. Now, one of the reasons that the small boats route is believed to have developed over the last few years is that it became more difficult with a lot of the enforcement in northern France to come on lorries. But those other routes like lorries or air travel do still exist, and many people are using them. So it's possible that you might see a shift back to other routes where people are less likely to be detected. The other consequences one could potentially see, for example, even if people have a valid asylum claim, if they're worried that they might be sent to Rwanda, they may just decide not to make a claim where previously they would have done so. So I think, you know, to the extent that the Rwanda policy does have an impact, certainly one of the impacts you would expect is deterring asylum claims among people who still manage to get to the UK, but will just live here longer term as irregular migrants.
And it also might have the effect of having fewer people arrive by boat, because that's too obvious.
Yes, I think the impact on the small boats route is very uncertain. It might depend on how likely people think it is that they will be transported to Rwanda and how big the numbers are. But we also have to remember that actually a fair amount of research on the way that asylum seekers make decisions suggests that people often don't have very accurate information about what the policies are. And in some cases, you know, their decisions are either based on sort of incorrect information that they've been given by people smugglers or others in their networks. And so we shouldn't necessarily expect a really direct effect of, you know, policy announcement translating into sort of, you know, what you would rationally expect people to do in response. It can actually be quite unpredictable how people respond to these types of policies.
Madeline, as far as you know, what would stop somebody who'd been sent to Rwanda leaving Rwanda and getting back on the people smuggling route to Britain?
Under the wording of the agreement with Rwanda, it seems nothing. At least in theory, the agreement says that people won't be detained in Rwanda, that they'll be able to come and go from their accommodation. And I think it's a pretty reasonable assumption that many of them won't want to stay in Rwanda. And if they had a strong rationale for being in the UK, such as, you know, having family connections here, they might come back if, of course, they can afford it. And one of the big impacts of the policy, I think, from the perspective of asylum seekers who are transported, would just be to greatly increase the costs of their asylum journey.
And to increase the dangers?
Yes, there are multiple dangers that people face along asylum routes, including destitution and risks of exploitation. And if the route becomes harder and more expensive, then those risks are expected to increase.
Do you think a year from now, this scheme will be operating?
I don't know. It's a very good question. I suspect there will be a fair amount of litigation, and indeed, the memorandum of understanding itself anticipates that. So I think we're going to have to await the outcome of that process. It's very difficult to say.
Madeline's assumption. And my conclusion to all that is, well, it's a bold plan, which quite possibly won't work. My thanks to Mark Easton, Nick Rollison, Alexander Betts and Madeline Sumption. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Ben Carter and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by Rod Farker. The editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. Anyway, if you enjoyed it, you can find many others on BBC Sounds.
Hello, this is Jane Garvey with some good news. Life Changing is back, and I can honestly tell you that we have found some really remarkable individuals for this series. People who've lived through extraordinary life-changing moments. Now, here's just a quick taster of what's in store for you.
And I was calling, Mayday, 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 and a ship answered. And I thought, thank goodness. We've got the starboard railings are in the water, we're rolling around, and we're sinking. So he said, what is your position? So I said, we're about halfway between the port of East London and Durban. No, what are your coordinates, he says. So I said, well, I don't know what the coordinates are. And I could hear sort of, what rank are you? So I was saying, well, I'm not a ranker, I'm a guitarist. And he said, what are you doing on the bridge? So I said, well, there's nobody else here.
You might need a strong brew and some steady nerves for that one. It's quite a story. Honestly, I've been blown away by what so-called ordinary human beings are capable of. Don't miss this series of Life Changing. These stories and these people are definitely going to improve your day. Join us if you can. Subscribe now to Life Changing on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.